What happens for you when you sing?
Ooh. Probably the same thing that happens when I'm really in a writing mode. I feel like I disappear, which is a very cool feeling.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the Western United States. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio. I'm Sarah Aronson, talking with Kelly Sherman about her collection of poetry and prose, Popular Music. The music in this show is provided by Kelly and her band Sung Mountains. Stay with us. I'm going to have you jump in, and I just love for you to read the first page of the book, Popular Music.
The infiltration of art by meaninglessness threatens the ability of art to be taken seriously. Anyway, it's a beautiful song. I don't know what else you want me to say.
The Chicago Review of Books named Popular Music Best Poetry of 2016, noting, Popular Music is both a love letter to music and a hilarious and heartbreaking investigation of our relationship to technology, nature, and country. Kelly, what's your relationship to America?
What a great question. I think that I'm constantly investigating that relationship. And as a person who grew up in Northern California, just absolutely surrounded by pristine natural beauty, which is something that I think our country is so blessed with. You know, I lived on the coast and so received the benefit of beaches, mountains, woods. And I associate those things heavily with this country, having had the opportunity to travel around it and to see much of it. I can attest to how beautiful the actual land is. And I suppose that's where a lot of my just confusion, fear, disappointment comes from in navigating the sort of culture and politics of the country. And definitely throughout this book, I'm sort of traveling through not only the landscape, but also my sort of complicated feelings about that relationship.
In one of your poems, you write, "The great dream of our age is to love what you are paid for. The great myth of our age is that this happens how we want." What are the dreams and myths your art is in conversation with?
I guess the biggest dream is that we all individually are able to chase the thing that we want to, and to walk down whatever road we choose, to follow our instincts, to live a life that is addressing or realizing what it is we think we're here to do. And I think that I'm bothered by the fundamental unfairness that many systems sort of have to offer people who don't have that opportunity. And so, to the best of my ability, I try to follow those threads. And I'm very fortunate to live in Missoula, Montana, which is a beautiful place, good for writers. But it is difficult to be an artist in America and the world. And so for me, my dreams and myths are just about self-realization, self-actualization, and becoming the person who I think I am. And that's just what I really hope for everyone else as well.
From the outside, I look at your life, you know, you're also a ceramicist and a musician and a writer who's produced beautiful works. Do you feel like you're living this life? Do you feel like you're getting paid for what you love?
Thank you. And I mean, I do. I'm under no illusion that I'll ever reach a place where I won't have to worry about money or, you know, the sort of basic everyday stresses that we all face. But I think that to choose to follow the path that you truly believe in is a constant labor of love, constant work. And to me, it's worth it, even though, you know, it's not potentially as stable or lucrative as other paths. It doesn't seem like a real hard choice for me.
You enter this conversation directly in one of your prose pieces, and I was hoping you'd read us a section from it.
Yes. I wrote this piece about a summer that I spent working on a farm with one of my best friends. It was right after I graduated from college in 2008. And that was a very just tumultuous time, I think, to be kicked out of the comfy womb of college and to realize that not only was the world sort of in chaos for a lot of other people, but that I was 22, relatively inexperienced, and needing to sort of get my bearings in a time and place where most other people were also losing theirs. And after sort of a few fits and starts, we had this opportunity to just sort of disappear into a remote farming setup. And we took it out of probably some idea of romanticism, but it was meaningful not only for the distance it gave us from the chaos of the world, but also in the sense that it really provided us a sense of peace and security that the greater outside world at that time didn't. And so because of that, it was an incredibly meaningful experience in a lot of ways. And I returned to that place and feeling a lot in my mind, just sort of trying to access again what that felt like to have, I guess, comfort or security. The summer after graduating college, my best friend and I moved onto a small farm in the remote mountains of Northern California. The American economy had just collapsed, and with the possibility of entering the job market removed from the table, we decided to dedicate that summer to the performance art piece of sacred, irresponsible experience. We packed our clothes, books, and art supplies into the trunk of my car and drove north from San Francisco into the remote hills of Humboldt County, ready to shape our lives around what we envisioned to be a kind of off-grid utopia, falling asleep to the white noise of generators, hardening into the sort of peaceful revolutionaries we believed should inherit the earth. We arrived with an earnestness I can now just barely recognize. We took pictures of the tops of trees. The sky was wild there, a gradient blue that encouraged weather without ever actually hosting any. We were welcomed by a weird kinship of builders who pointed out the creek and instructed us to make ourselves at home. We were being paid, it seemed, to plug several metaphysical holes in the scene. I say this because we had very few important tasks, and we were encouraged to take our time with the ones we did have, weeding around forgotten tool sheds, picking blackberries for the boys, things like that. During our lunch breaks, we scratched down our thoughts or stretched out smoking with the other workers on the deck. We rode four-wheelers up the long logging roads to the greenhouses in our sports bras, watering the plants for whole days alone. In our free time, we tried our best to continue with what we had tasked ourselves with throughout our school years. researching the world in an attempt to understand and improve upon it. We read books by dead philosophers and living musicians, dated newspaper articles about civil wars on other continents. What can we do, we wondered, though everything seemed to be working out fine. Translucent weeks went by. We tallied our earnings and spun our wheels.
I laughed so hard when I read the performance art piece of the sacred irresponsible experience. What do you think that is for American youth?
Ooh. I mean, I think it looks different for every person, but I also think that it's something that is beneficial to go through. Whatever that feels like or whatever opportunities are presented, I think that part of growing up, especially if you're looking for experience or knowledge of the world, is to just follow those little breadcrumbs, follow those threads. And to me, the best way to think about those, maybe what other people would call mistakes or irresponsibilities, is more about communing with the possibilities of your own life and putting yourself out to whatever currents might take you in either direction, and knowing that it's all contributing to some larger story.
And later in the piece, you write about the Martin Scorsese film, The Last Waltz, which, of course, is the music documentary about the band. And it was the only movie that you had to watch. And you put it on at all times of day. And I was thinking about that notion of whether it's an album that you put on repeat or a film that you watch over and over again. I want to know how that ritual experience affected you.
Oh, I mean, we were obsessed with this movie. I think a lot of it had to do with the fact that we were so hungry for direction, so hungry for someone, an artist with a capital A, to tell us what to do and where to go. Without maybe acknowledging that to ourselves or each other, but sort of being in this place and being held here and thinking about these big questions of who we were and how we were going to fit into the world, I think that this film sort of became the closest thing to an instruction manual that we had. And so watching all of these musicians go up and sing their songs, I think in a way we saw it as their own manifestos of a creative life lived. And the sharing of the knowledge that they had earned through their own experiences. It was very encouraging and also heartbreaking, as it is to see famous artists or musicians do the thing that they're supposed to do and just hope that you're going to get there someday as well.
In that piece, I also found more of the original conceit of your book, in which you write, "Increasingly, I do not recognize the world into which I was born and into which I have no choice but to grow. More and more, popular music seems to represent the affirmation of and participation in a fictional and destructive machine outside me entirely, commanding me to get going. When I believe this world, I am able to listen. When I return to the old voices, it's because I can't believe what the world has become." What is it about this world that has become, that has you, you know, go back to the old voices? And who are the old voices you return to?
I think the old voices for me are the people that I reference in this essay. So I grew up seeking solace in 60s and 70s folk musicians and poets, Joni Mitchell, Neil Young, Bob Dylan, and those people. I found them at a time when I was just discovering poetry and music. And because of that and because of their influence, I think those two things are forever permanently linked for me. And, you know, when I listen to their songs, I hear something in them that feels instructive, or that feels like a human being trying to reach out and touch others. And I think art, in its highest capacity, does that. And I think, at the risk of sounding 100 years old, that I see that less and less, or feel that less and less in music that is popular now. And so the idea of finding instruction, finding solace in what we're currently singing about, what narratives we're currently making, it's hard for me to see it as being helpful in the same way.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to a conversation with Kelly Sherman about her collection of poetry and prose, Popular Music. I'm Sarah Aronson. This is The Right Question. Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. In the second half, we'll talk about true love and enter the world of Kelly's latest work.
I want to ask you to read one of your other poems, please. Kelly, will you read page 89?
We make a practice of attempting to describe water. We photograph a mountain, but it never really turns out. When I learn something about myself, I pitch a small rock into a river. Only other people's songs feel weightless and true.
I was thinking about that, the last two lines, only other people's songs feel weightless and true. What were you imagining at the time you wrote that, and why that sentiment?
I guess maybe this came from learning to play music and how easy it is to perform a song written by someone else, because there's a distance there in just being the conduit. As opposed to when I began writing songs, I felt so overwhelmed with the meaning and whether I was saying the right thing and whether others would know what I was talking about and whether I was right or not. And I think that kind of scrutiny that we use to look at our own work is something that we don't necessarily apply to the work of others, whether it's songs or poems. Personally, when I read other people's poems, I see them as complete objects. When I listen to music that someone else has made, I view it as whole, and I totally receive it thinking that it's true. But I struggle, and I don't think I could be alone in this struggle with feeling the same amount of confidence and trust in the poems I write or the songs that I write, let alone performing them for others. And I just think that's a very interesting kind of dissonance in the duality of making and also consuming art.
I want to switch gears and talk about love. Will you read another poem?
Resource maps are so confrontational. Peak oil is so 2008. It makes sense that everything is so f***ed up. Think about the way you felt before you found your one true love.
There's also a long poem at the end, and you write, "What an elegant sacrifice it is to be in love, to be in real love, and still to have to exchange money for food two or three times a day." What does it mean to you to write so unabashedly and vulnerably about love and true love and real love?
Well, it's very important to me. This book especially would 100% not exist were it not for me encountering that sentiment. So, a little behind the scenes to Popular Music. I actually submitted this manuscript and it was almost completely different. No essays, no long poem at the end, just a series of poems. Before it was accepted, I met the person who I am currently dating. We've been together for 5 years. And after I met him, I got the call to say, I would love to publish this book. And I realized that not only was my life completely different, my mind felt completely different, but I realized that my book had to be completely different. And so this book, in a sense, is a product of that initial outpouring of beliefs, the sharing of all your experiences and feelings about the world or yourself and your place in it that happens when you first fall in love with someone. I really wanted to leave those parts in there and to make this book essentially a love letter to the things that I had experienced, to this person that I had just met that was really helping all of these things come out, and to art and music and poetry in general, and to the things that I felt about them. So it's a funny experience to feel, as I wrote, so differently after finding my true love and still be in a country that makes that being in love often so difficult and so jarring. But I like the idea that both can coexist and that they have to.
I'd love for you to read a section from the long poem at the end of this book.
When you seek love above all else, the world will reward you with no money. When you learn how to stomach atrocity, you will be asked to do it again and again. It will be so difficult and wonderful to start over, as you will be forced to do many more times before your death. Whatever instrument you have chosen to bear the weight of your whole self, sit with it now and let it be your life. Sit with your whole life now and let it take its billowing shape before you. Get it over and done with. Sit down now with the sound of your actual voice and listen to what it begs you to do. Great floating beings above you will ask you to keep them afloat, but you are not required to do this. Sleep and drink clean water. Blackberries grow for free. I am here with you, country, love of my life. I fight to find my body inside you because I must, and you will thank me. You will make me beautiful, though you do not need me. I am going alone now, but alongside you. And I love you so entirely, I forget how to talk.
One of the things that struck me when I heard you read for the first time, Kelly, is you don't use poet voice. And in that piece, you write about your actual voice. And I want to know, how do you trust the way you read out loud?
That's a really good question. I struggled with this for a long time because when I was first learning how to read my work out loud, I went to readings and listened to readers. And especially for women, I found that there were a few styles of reading, none of which I particularly felt drawn to or that I could genuinely perform. I thought that the thing that I respected and admired most from hearing poets read their work was a kind of authenticity and ease of voice that really allowed the sentiment to come out. I try with my work to read in a way that gets out of the way of the thoughts on paper. I personally get very distracted at some readings. And so I really just want to deliver in a way that feels authentic to the tone and to the content of the poem.
Will you take us out with a poem from your forthcoming collection, The New World, from the section called The Dreams?
Revealing. I found a note I'd written to myself months or years ago. Let my dad hear my voice more often. Sent him a video of falling snow. Why do I keep forgetting what it means to be here on Earth? When you really grab a hold of it, saying thank you, revealing yourself. I would be dead without my friends calling to tell me their theories about advertisements. I would be dead without music or poems. Just play along with me. Snow falling on my screen. Animals are beautiful, and they want your attention. They want you to make their world better, and I wish I could. I wish I could have more time on this earth to become what I could be, and then what I actually am.
Kelly Sherman lives in Missoula, Montana as a ceramicist, musician, and writer. The music featured in this program is the track Berries from the album Sanctuary by her band Sung Mountains. Look for more information about her and her work at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and visit our Facebook page. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting us since 2008. And thanks to you for listening. I'm Sarah Aronson, and this has been The Right Question.
The Right Question is produced by Sarah Aronson, Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer,